On a remote sea cliff, high above the Pacific, along the Big Sur coast, the young falcon perched on the edge of a rocky shelf that was her nest. Her dark eyes carefully followed her father flying below her, clutching in his talons a freshly killed sandpiper, and behind him chased her brother, wailing and begging for the food that her father carried. And she felt the urge to join him in the sky, but she wasn't quite ready yet. She gripped the rocks with her talons, and she flapped her newly feathered wings, not taking off, but the air currents puffing up debris from the nest, feathers and down and bits of burned bone and ashes. And some of those burned bones and ashes actually found their way into her body when her parents had fed her the meat, and it stuck to the meat and went into her body. But that was earlier. Now she was 38 days old. She was ready to fly. Her father winged by the perch again, still holding on to that sandpiper, her brother close behind, and she could resist no longer. She joined him in the wailing for the begging, and she pushed off with her talons, and away she flew from the ashes in the nest, out into the air for the first time, a free-flying wild creature. In 1983, I was up in the North Fork of the Kings River, surveying that drainage for goshawks and peregrine falcons. And I got a call from my supervisor, and he said, "Hey, I'm sending this guy up there to help you. His name's John Ball. I hope you get along with him. He's a little different." Several days later, I heard what sounded like Pink Floyd thumping up the canyon towards the cabin I was living in, and around the bend came this dark blue 69 Metro van. It was kind of like a converted bread truck or an old SWAT van. And he pulls up into the driveway, and out of the van steps John Allen Zach Ball. And it turns out he had spent the winter in this van, the previous winter in this van, over on the east side of the Sierra at about 9,000 feet buried in a snowbank. He had a power cord to the van, and then he had a snow tunnel that dug down to the doorway of the van. And then several days earlier, he had just dug the thing out of the snowbank and drove over to the west side of the Sierra to meet me. Little did we know our lives were about to change. John Ball, most people called him Zach, was a short, stocky, bearded man. Slightly balding, thick glasses, but usually very stylish glasses. He was not fat. He was a wiry, energetic man full of charisma and testosterone. But I was dismayed to find out that he was not a biologist. Instead, he had studied English and poetry and prose and loved philosophy. But the thing that qualified him for this job is that he was a falconer. He knew falcons. He knew birds of prey. And what he lacked for in his biological knowledge, he more than made up for in his enthusiasm to pursue this career as a raptor biologist. Now, later I found out that his previous career before he did this was that of venture capital in the streets of L.A. during the high-flying 80s. But a nasty, nasty auto accident changed all that. And he said after his auto accident, he found himself lying on the ground, gazing up at a ring of Native American elders staring down at him, discussing whether it was his time or not, when suddenly he heard a voice that said, "We have a pulse," and he was snapped back into this life. And after that, he turned his back on the streets and the high-rises of the city and devoted his life to the mountains and the fields and birds of prey. And for the first 2 years that I knew John, we lived in the High Sierra. We worked in the Southwest. And we were each other's teachers and mentors. And we had so many experiences. Some of you have heard some of the things that we did and some of the stories I've told here in the past. And we had so many learning experiences. We had some spectacular failures, some amazing successes. And to try and distill the impact that this man had on my life and those he chose as his friends and lovers into an 8 to 10 minute story it's impossible. The guy was a man who was at home on the edge. He was a bright, energetic ball careening through life, altering the trajectory of anybody he met. He had this way where he could get other people to willingly accommodate his needs. I mean, if we needed a vehicle, a car, a Jeep, a boat, a place to live, a plane, a helicopter, he could do it. He made it happen. At times, it almost seemed like like sorcery. He was able to arrange for us to fly into the middle fork of the Kings River, a place at this remote valley called Tehipity Valley. We flew in there like 7 different times, and we would land there. They'd drop us off in there, and we would work for sometimes, you know, days or weeks at a time, camping there, exploring the area, looking for rafters. He had a policy, not a policy. It was a club, is what he called. He called it the Captain's Stupid Club, all right? And the Captain's Stupid Club had 3 rules. Rule number 1 was nothing matters. Rule number 2 was you can make a living doing something you enjoy. And rule number 3 was if you have a problem with rule number 2, see rule number 1. Nothing matters. His one corollary was never underestimate the power of capillary action. And not just in fluids, but in life in general. There's so many images that I have of this man. One that is burned into my memory is when he did his hack site with his first wife up in the High Sierra. And the hack site is a place where they release peregrine falcons. At any rate, there was his wife with her long blonde hair and her easy manner, and there's John in his loincloth with hiking boots, a buckskin shirt, a red and white Rising Sun Kamikaze bandana on his head, and a .357 Colt Python slung low on his hip. We have problems with eagles, and that's a whole other story. Later on, he settled down. He settled down in the mountains with his second wife, who is a dear woman who kind of balanced and grounded him, but gave him her blessing that he could continue some of his adventures. And he would disappear up into Alaska, and he would spend weeks floating down the Noatak River up by the Arctic Circle, surveying those drainages for birds of prey and rafters. But as so often is the case, the brightest flames burn out the quickest. And in 1990... In the spring of 1990, on Earth Day, I got a phone call from a mutual friend informing me that John had died in a crash in the foothills of the Sierra while trying to learn how to fly an ultralight craft. He was 38 years old. It was decided that his memorial would be held the following weekend at one of our favorite campsites in a meadow in Kings Canyon. Over 100 people showed up in the clearing in the bottom of that canyon on that spring day. The redbud was in bloom. The buckeye had its nice, bright green growth. Chairs were set out. A podium was brought in. John's ashes were in like a metal, bronze-colored metal box that was hung from the podium in a bright purple Crown Royal bag. Stories were told and shared, and tears were shared, and whiskey and weed were shared by people from all over the West. And you know, after the speeches and the food and the drink, the crowd kind of thinned out to a core group of 30 people who it was quickly evident were not going to go anywhere that day. And they would be there for the following sunrise. They might not be awake for it, but they would be there, okay? And then later on, kind of a small group of us got together with John's remains, his box in the sack. Zach in a sack, because that's what most people call him, Zach. Anyway, Zach in the sack in the middle of us, and we were discussing what we were going to do with him. And somebody got the box out and got a big knife out and started prying the box open. And when we revealed the box in the lantern light, we could see that the ashes were like the size of fine gravel. And you could see little bits of burned bone on it. And they were iridescent and very light to the touch. And so we decided that we would, and somebody was like, should we be doing this? And we're like, yeah, John wouldn't mind, you know. He loved this part. Anyway, we decided that we would send him off to all the places that he loved. And so his friend from Alaska took some of his ashes back up to the Noatak River and put him in the river up there. And another friend from Wyoming took his ashes up to Wyoming, where he loved to go hawking, and he lived for a while. We took some of his ashes back into Tehipity Valley that spring for our last trip and left some there. His climbing buddy, Millis, took some of the ashes and mixed it in with his climbing chalk. That way, he said, he could always go climbing with his buddy, Zach. You know? Both of his wives took some of the ashes and put them in their special places. And then finally, in May, we found ourselves walking up a long, steep trail to a remote sea cliff high above the Pacific along the Big Sur coast. With us, we had the remains of John's ashes, and we had 2 downy peregrine falcon chicks. And these chicks were to be fostered into a nest of peregrines whose eggs were too thin to hatch. And as the climbers went down into that nest, the adults were cacking and diving on them, trying to defend their nests. And the climbers got in there and they took these artificial eggs out of the nest that had been put in there earlier to keep the birds tight on that territory. And then they took John's ashes and they spread John's ashes in the nest with the dirt and the gravel in there. And then they carefully placed the baby peregrines right there in John's ashes. About a month later, I went back up to that cliff, and I remember sitting up there, looking down over the ocean, watching the gray whales move north with their calves. And then I heard off to the side, I heard the sound of two peregrines kind of chittering, chasing something. And I looked over, and about eye level, I could see this male peregrine zipping by with a sandpiper in its talons, and these two young peregrines tumbling past him. And I thought, man, John loved this place, and he would have loved this sight. New wildlife. Born like ashes on the wind.